Literature Out Loud, Sonnet 111 by William Shakespeare. Oh, for my sake, do you with fortune chide, the guilty goddess of my harmful deeds, that did not better for my life provide than public means which public manners breeds. Thence comes it that my name receives a brand, and almost thence my nature is subdued to what it works in, like the dyer's hand. Pity me then, and wish I were renewed, whilst, like a willing patient, I will drink potions of eisel against my strong infection. No bitterness that I will bitter think, nor double penance to correct correction. Pity me then, dear friend, and I assure ye, even that your pity is enough to cure me. Literature Out Loud, Sonnet 112 by William Shakespeare. Your love and pity doth the impression fill which vulgar scandal stamped upon my brow. For what care I who calls me well or ill, so you or green my bad, my good allow? You are my all the world, and I must strive to know my shames and praises from your tongue. None else to me, nor I to none alive, that my steel dent rung. In so profound abysm I throw all care of other voices, that my adder's sense to critic and to flatterer stop it are. Mark, how with my neglect I do dispense. You are so strongly in my purpose bred that all the world besides, methinks, are dead. Literature Out Loud, Sonnet 113 by William Shakespeare. Since I left you, mine eye is in my mind, and that which governs me to go about doth part his function and is partly blind, seems seeing, but effectually is out. For it no form delivers to the heart of bird, of flower, or shape, which it doth latch. Of his quick objects hath the mind no part, nor his own vision holds what it doth catch. For if it see the rudest or gentlest sight, the most sweet favor or deformedst creature, the mountain or the sea, the day or night, the crow or dove, it shapes them to your feature. Incapable of more, replete with you, my most true mind thus makes mine eye untrue. Literature Out Loud, Sonnet 114 by William Shakespeare. Whether doth my mind, being crowned with you, drink up the monarch's plague, this flattery, or whether shall I say, mine eye saith true, and that your love taught it this alchemy, to make of monsters and things indigest such cherubins as your sweet self resemble, creating every bad a perfect best, as fast as objects to his beams assemble. Oh, 'tis the first. 'Tis flattery in my seeing, and my great mind most kingly drinks it up. Mine eye well knows what with his gust is greeing, and to his palate doth prepare the cup. If it be poisoned, 'tis the lesser sin that mine eye loves it, and doth first begin. Literature Out Loud, Sonnet 115 by William Shakespeare. Those lines that I before have writ do lie, even those that said I could not love you dearer. Yet then my judgment knew no reason why my most full flame should afterwards burn clearer. But reckoning time, whose millioned accidents creep in twixt vows and change decrees of kings, tan sacred beauty, blunt the sharpest intents, divert strong minds to the course of altering things. Alas! Why, fearing of time's tyranny, might I not then say, now I love you best, when I was certain or uncertainty, crowning the present, doubting of the rest? Love is a babe. Then might I not say so, to give full growth to that which still doth grow? Literature Out Loud, Sonnet 116 by William Shakespeare. Let me not to the marriage of true minds admit impediments. Love is not love which alters when it alteration finds, or bends with the remover to remove. Oh no, it is an ever fixed mark that looks on tempests and is never shaken. It is the star to every wandering bark whose worth's unknown, although his height be taken. Love's not time's fool, though rosy lips and cheeks within his bending sickle's compass come. Love alters not with his brief hours and weeks, but bears it out even to the edge of doom. If this be error and upon me proved, I never writ, nor no man ever loved. Literature Out Loud, Sonnet 117 by William Shakespeare. Accuse me thus, that I have scanted all wherein I should your great deserts repay. Forgot upon your dearest love to call, whereto all bonds do tie me day by day. That I have frequent been with unknown minds and given to time your own dear purchased right. That I have hoisted sail to all the winds which should transport me farthest from your sight. Book both my willfulness and errors down, and on just proof surmise accumulate, bring me within the level of your frown, but shoot not at me in your wakened hate, since my appeal says I did strive to prove the constancy and virtue of your love. Literature Out Loud, Sonnet 118 by William Shakespeare. Like as, to make our appetites more keen, with eager compounds we our palate urge. As, to prevent our maladies unseen, we sicken to shun sickness when we purge. Even so, being tough of your ne'er cloying sweetness, to bitter sauces did I frame my feeding, and sick of welfare, found a kind of meatness to be diseased ere that there was true needing. Thus policy and love, to anticipate the ills that were not, grew to faults assured, and brought to medicine a healthful state, which rank of goodness would by ill be cured. But thence I learn, and find the lesson true, drugs poison him that so fell sick of you. Literature Out Loud, Sonnet 119 by William Shakespeare. Potions have I drunk of siren tears, distilled from limbics foul as hell within, applying fears to hopes and hopes to fears, still losing when I saw myself to win. What wretched errors hath my heart committed, whilst it hath thought itself so blessed never? How have mine eyes out of their spheres been fitted in the distraction of this madding fever? O benefit of ill! Now I find true that better is by evil still made better, and ruined love, when it is built anew, grows fairer than at first, more strong, far greater. So I return rebuked to my content, and gain by ill thrice more than I have spent. Literature Out Loud, Sonnet 120 by William Shakespeare. That you were once unkind befriends me now, and for that sorrow which I then did feel, needs must I, under my transgression, bow, unless my nerves were brass or hammered steel. For if you were by my unkindness shaken as I by yours, you've passed a hell of time, and I, a tyrant, have no leisure taken to weigh how once I suffered in your crime. Oh, that our night of woe might have remembered my deepest sense, how hard true sorrow hits, and soon to you, as you to me, then tendered the humble slave, which wounded bosoms fits. But that your trespass now becomes a fee, mine ransoms yours, and yours must ransom me. Son, it's 111 through 120 from Literature Out Loud. I've been recording these programs and making them available as a free podcast for more than 2 years. Anything you hear in abundance is available 24/7 by visiting danealred.com. That's danealred.com. You're listening to Abundance. I'm Dan Allred, your host. Welcome to my expression of thanks for the 1001 things I love about this universe. You've been listening to Shakespeare Sonnets. These and many other selections are available for anyone to read at your leisure. Literature Out Loud. Celebrating Humility, number 542. Literature Out Loud, The Robber Bridegroom by the Brothers Grimm. Once upon a time, there was a miller who had one beautiful daughter, and as she was grown up, he was anxious that she should be well married and provided for. He said to himself, "I will give her to the first suitable man who comes and asks for her hand." Not long after, a suitor appeared. And as he appeared to be very rich, and the miller could see nothing in him with which to find fault, he betrothed his daughter to him. But the girl did not care for the man as a girl ought to care for her betrothed husband. She did not feel that she could trust him. And she could not look at him nor think of him without an inward shudder. One day he said to her, "You have not yet paid me a visit, although we have been betrothed for some time." "I do not know where your house is," she answered. "My house is out there in the dark forest," he said. She tried to excuse herself by saying that she would not be able to find the way thither. Her betrothed replied, "You must come and see me next Sunday. I have already invited guests for that day, and that you may not mistake the way, I will strew ashes along the path." When Sunday came, and it was time for the girl to start, a feeling of dread came over her which she could not explain. And that she might be able to find her path again, she filled her pockets with peas and lentils to sprinkle on the ground as she went along. On reaching the entrance to the forest, she found the path strewed with ashes, and these she followed, throwing down some peas on either side of her at every step she took. She walked the whole day until she came to the deepest, darkest part of the forest. There she saw a lonely house, looking so grim and mysterious that it did not please her at all. She stepped inside, but not a soul was to be seen, and a great silence reigned throughout. Suddenly a voice cried, turn back, young maiden fair, linger not in this murderer's lair." The girl looked up and saw that the voice came from a bird hanging in a cage on the wall. Again it cried, turn back, young maiden fair, linger not in this murderer's lair." The girl passed on, going from room to room of the house, but they were all empty, and still she saw no one. At last she came to the cellar, and there sat a very, very old woman who could not keep her head from shaking. "Can you tell me," asked the girl, "if my betrothed husband lives here?" Ah, you poor child, answered the old woman. What a place for you to come to. This is a murderer's den. You think yourself a promised bride, and that your marriage will soon take place, but it is with death that you will keep your marriage feast. Look, do you see that large cauldron of water which I am obliged to keep on the fire? As soon as they have you in their power, they will kill you without mercy, and cook you and eat you, for they are eaters of men. If I did not take pity on you and save you, you would be lost. Thereupon the old woman led her behind a large cask, which quite hid her from view. Keep still as a mouse, she said. Do not move or speak, or it will be all over with you. Tonight, when the robbers are all asleep, we will flee together. I have long been waiting for an opportunity to escape. The words were hardly out of her mouth when the godless crew returned, dragging another young girl along with them. They were all drunk and paid no heed to her cries and lamentations. They gave her wine to drink, 3 glasses full, one of white wine, one of red, and one of yellow. And with that her heart gave way and she died. Then they tore off her dainty clothing, laid her on a table, and cut her beautiful body into pieces, and sprinkled salt upon it. The poor betrothed girl crouched trembling and shuddering behind the cask, for she saw what a terrible fate had been intended for her by the robbers. One of them now noticed a gold ring still remaining on the little finger of the murdered girl, and as he could not draw it off easily, he took a hatchet and cut off the finger. But the finger sprang into the air and fell behind the cask into the lap of the girl who was hiding there. The robber took a light and began looking for it, but he could not find it. "Have you looked behind the large cask?" said one of the others. But the old woman called out, "Come and eat your suppers, and let the thing be till tomorrow. The finger won't run away." "The old woman is right," said the robbers, and they ceased looking for the finger and sat down. The old woman then mixed a sleeping draught with their wine, and before long they were all lying on the floor of the cellar, fast asleep and snoring. As soon as the girl was assured of this, she came from behind the cask. She was obliged to step over the bodies of the sleepers who were lying close together, and every moment she was filled with renewed dread lest she should awaken them. But God helped her, so that she passed safely over them, and then she and the old woman went upstairs, opened the door, and hastened as fast as they could from the murderer's den. They found the ashes scattered by the wind, but the peas and lentils had sprouted and grown sufficiently above the ground to guide them in the moonlight along the path. All night long they walked, and it was morning before they reached the mill. Then the girl told her father all that had happened. The day came that had been fixed for the marriage. The bridegroom arrived, and also a large company of guests, for the miller had taken care to invite all his friends and relations. As they sat for the feast, each guest in turn was asked to tell a tale. The bride sat still and did not say a word. "And you, my love," said the bridegroom, turning to her, "is there no tale you know? Tell us something." "I will tell you a dream, then," said the bride. "I went alone through a forest, and came at last to a house. Not a soul could I find within, but a bird that was hanging in a cage on the wall cried out, 'Turn back, yon maiden fair, linger not in this murderer's lair.' Again, a second time it said these words, 'Oh, my darling, this is only a dream.' I went on through the house from room to room, but they were all empty, and everything was so grim and mysterious. At last I went down to the cellar, and there sat a very, very old woman who could not keep her head still. I asked her if my betrothed lived there, and she answered, 'Ah, you poor child, you are coming to a murderer's den. Your betrothed does indeed live here, but he will kill you without mercy, and afterwards cook and eat you.' 'My darling, this is only a dream.' The old woman hid me behind a large cask, and scarcely had she done this when the robbers returned home, dragging a young girl along with them. They gave her 3 kinds of wine to drink, white, red, and yellow, and with that she died. 'My darling, this is only a dream.' Then they tore off her dainty clothing and cut her beautiful body into pieces and sprinkled salt upon it. 'My darling, this is only a dream.' And one of the robbers saw that there was a gold ring still left on her finger, and as it was difficult to draw off, he took a hatchet and cut off her finger. But the finger sprang into the air and fell behind the great cask into my lap. And here is the finger with the ring." And with these words the bride drew forth a finger and showed it to the assembled guests. The bridegroom, who during this recital had grown deadly pale, up and tried to escape, but the guests seized him and held him fast. They delivered him up to justice, and he and all his murderous band were condemned to death for their wicked deeds. Literature Out Loud, The Last Bargain, by Rabindranath Tagore. The Last Bargain. "Come and hire me," I cried, while in the morning I was walking on the stone-paved road. Sword in hand, the king came in his chariot. He held my hand and said, "I will hire you with my power." But his power counted for naught, and he went away in his chariot. In the heat of the midday, the houses stood with shut doors. I wandered along the crooked lane. An old man came out with his bag of gold. He pondered and said, "I will hire you with my money." He weighed his coins one by one, but I turned away. It was evening. The garden hedge was all aflower. The fair maid came out and said, "I will hire you with a smile." Her smile paled and melted into tears, and she went back alone into the dark. The sun glistened on the sand, and the sea waves broke waywardly. A child sat playing with shells. He raised his head and seemed to know me and said, "I will hire you with nothing." From thenceforth, that bargain struck in child's play, made me a free man. Literature Out Loud, The Blind Men and the Elephant, by John Godfrey Sachs. It was six men of Indostan, to learning much inclined, who went to see the elephant, though all of them were blind, that each, by observation, might satisfy his mind. The first approached the elephant, and happening to fall against his broad and sturdy side, at once began to bawl, "God bless me, but the elephant is very like a wall." The second, feeling of the tusk, cried, "Oh, what have we here, so very round and smooth and sharp? To me 'tis mighty clear, this wonder of an elephant is very like a spear." The third approached the animal, and happening to take the squirming trunk within his hands, thus boldly up and spake, "I see," quoth he, "the elephant is very like a snake." The fourth reached out an eager hand and felt about the knee. "What most this wondrous beast is like is mighty plain," quoth he, "'tis clear enough the elephant is very like a tree." The fifth, who chanced to touch the ear, said, "E'en the blindest man can tell what this resembles most. Deny the fact who can, this marvel of an elephant is very like a fan." The sixth no sooner had begun about the beast to grope, than seizing on the swinging tail that fell within his scope, "I see," quoth he, "the elephant is very like a rope." And so these men of Indostan disputed loud and long, each in his own opinion, exceeding stiff and strong, though each was partly in the right, and all were in the wrong. Thank you. You're listening to Abundance. I'm your host, Dana Allred. I've had opportunities far beyond what could possibly be expected by someone like me, and if I can do it, you can too. I know you can find the abundance waiting for you in this world. This positive approach has helped me to do the things I've wanted to accomplish in my life, and this attitude of gratitude and positive expectations can help you get everything this life has to offer you. Because of the abundance this universe offers me, I want to give back in some small way. We are all on this journey together, and together, with what I can do and with what you can do, I know there is nothing that cannot be done. Let's get working on the kind of abundance you are seeking together.